Welcome to the History of Little Europe, episode 1.6, How Not to Run a Kingdom. Last time, we left off with the death of Charlemagne after a lifetime of unifying Western Europe. Now, I purposely avoided talking about the issue of succession until now, because it ends up being a very complicated story with a very simple end. Charlemagne was originally planning on carving up the kingdom among three of his sons, and the territory which each would receive was a constant issue of attention. But just a few years before his own death, two of the three sons died. And so, mostly by accident, Charlemagne did not repeat the mistake of every one of his predecessors, and the kingdom passed smoothly into the hands of his son, Louis the Pious. The fact that Charlemagne ended up having only one surviving male child means that, mostly by accident, he managed to avoid carving up the empire. It ended up not mattering, because the empire would be divided by Louis's sons. But the extra generation that the empire spent as something of a cohesive unit helped ensure that Central Europe grew accustomed to operating as a single central entity. The ascension of Louis did not ensure smooth sailing for the empire, though. It took almost everyone exactly no time at all to realize that he was not half the man his father was, and began descending on the empire like vultures. Charlemagne had conquered a far larger landmass than he could reasonably govern by himself. At this point, there was still great debate over whether the Pope had a right, much less a necessity, to do this. Many within Louis' court operated under the assumption that, since his father had held the title, it would automatically be transferred to his son. But by allowing the Pope to squeeze into the process for a second time, it all but confirmed that he was now a requirement for holding the title of emperor. The Pope had drawn the first blood, carving out a small bit of authority from Louis's reign. Smelling blood in the water, and with both the fringes and core of the empire now alienated, the various groups subjugated under Charlemagne began angling at reclaiming their former positions. But before we get into that, there was one more domino Louis needed to stack. On April 9th, 817, while crossing from the cathedral to his palace in Aachen, the gallery collapsed under the king, and much of his retinue died. Not only did this single event kill off most of the nobles still loyal to him, it forced him to confront the issue of succession immediately, and had only managed to hold it all together in his own lifetime through competent officials and sheer force of will. Louis lacked both of these things, and instead, his career would be characterized by trying to let as little of the empire break apart as possible. Not all of this was inevitable. Louis brought a fair amount of it upon himself. It began at the outset of his reign. His first act was to exile every man of even questioned religious faith from the administration, and to burn every Germanic pagan text that he got his hands on. While it would certainly earn him the title of pious, and win him some points with the clergy, it did nothing to sedate the rebellious Germans. Here was some French king, still pretending to be a Roman emperor, who was completely disrespecting the culture, and replacing their chosen leaders with foreigners who often were incompetent and had no understanding of the area and how they were governing. Needless to say, it didn't take long before they were up in arms. He then followed this up by allowing the Pope to travel to his court and crown him emperor. While Charlemagne had the good sense to not make any big plans until there was only one son left, Louis immediately drew up the new boundaries for his sons. We will discuss this in more detail a bit later, but just know that Lothair, the eldest, got the lion's share, and his brothers were not pleased. The first person to go after the new king was his nephew, Bernard, who was still in control of most of northern Italy, but whose position was now very much in question after Louis's new map of succession. He drew his troops up in rebellion, but after finding himself outnumbered, he quickly negotiated a surrender. Louis decided to start his reign with a different kind of message. After capturing Bernard, he tried him for treason and sentenced him to death. Feeling the mood, Louis then attempted to commute the sentence by reducing it to blinding, but the process ended up killing Bernard anyway, now in a more agonizing manner. Louis had managed to demonstrate that he was both weak in character and brutal in punishment in one single action, which is vaguely incredible. And then, just to show that he was weak-willed, he attempted to seek penance from the Pope personally for his action. and if getting to crown the emperor was a boon to the pope's power, hearing the king rattle off a bunch of minor offenses and seeking his personal blessing made him a political force to be reckoned with. The next 5 years or so managed to pass without major events. The tribes on the frontier made some trouble, and while Louis was unable to expand the borders of the kingdom, he fended off most of the hostile incursions with ease. In 820, Louis's first wife had died, and a second bore him a new son, who history knows as Charles the Bald. Louis then took the provocative step of carving a large chunk out of his eldest son's inheritance in the form of Alemannia, and giving it to Charles. This move would provoke a series of civil wars over the issue of succession that encompasses the entirety of the remainder of Louis's reign. So for our sake, let's lay out the full scene. Lothar, the eldest, holds the lion's share, encompassing northwest France, eastern Germany, the Benelux countries, and northern Italy. Pepin, the next oldest, had dominion over southern France in Aquitaine. The next youngest, confusingly also named Louis, held eastern Germany, and Charles holds Alemannia, which at this point encompasses basically all of Switzerland. Lothar, frustrated at seeing a chunk of territory carved out of his and given to a younger brother, joins forces with the other elder brothers, Pepin of Aquitaine and Louis of Germany, and marched on his father's capital of Aachen. Unfortunately for the brothers, however, as soon as this relatively simple task was accomplished, they fell to bickering, and their father was able to march back and reclaim his power. Remember that, while each thought they were getting too little land in their inheritance, for both Pepin and Louis, this would have meant carving land out of Lothar's territory. So each of the brothers is angling for something completely different. Now, 2 years later, the brothers decided once again that the status quo was unsatisfactory, and began gearing up for a campaign. Louis the Pious managed to preempt this one, though, and thoroughly crushed Pepin's forces in Aquitaine, before Louis of Germany managed to gather his forces. Louis then decided to push his luck. He named his son Charles, who was still far too young to fight his own battles, as king of Aquitaine, essentially denying Pepin any part of the inheritance. His favorite son, a more important kingdom, Lothar gets the territory he lost back, and Louis the German doesn't get punished for trying to amass an army of Slavic tribes. But Lothar decided, he then rescinded Charles's claim of Alemannia back to Lothar, who, will you remember, had started the first conflict because he lost that territory. Now, the only party left worse off through all of this was Pepin. Louis the Pious gets to take this opportunity to go all in. He sees his father continually messing about with an inheritance that suits him well at the moment, but could change the instant his father has a new favorite son. So Lothar began angling to outright depose his father and install himself as the emperor to ensure his future kingdom. But Louis decided to once again go looking for trouble in 829 when he took a look at his planned inheritance and decided it wasn't chaotic enough. To that end, Lothar teamed up with his now deposed brother Pepin and his still unhappy brother Louis and prepared to wage war against their father. The two armies eventually lined up against each other, but with neither side wanting to seem the aggressor, the conflict soon became a game of getting the other side to desert and winning over the Pope. The Pope, all too happy to now hold the authority over the ability to declare wars, eventually sided with the brothers, which, along with the efforts of some nobles, caused most of Louis's army to defect over to their side. Seeing that the situation was hopeless, Louis decided to surrender. Now, with the emperor in custody, Lothar was left as the de facto ruler of Francia, but while attempting to hammer out terms, the three brothers once again fell into infighting. After months of squabbling, they resigned to the fact that they could not reach an agreement, and Louis the Pious basically walked right back into the position of emperor. All of this was helped by Lothar suddenly falling very ill, taking him out of commission, and the nobility, ever the bandwagon force, lining up behind Louis. He would issue tough terms of surrender, but recognizing that taking his sons out of power would just spark further conflict, he kept both Lothar and Pepin in control over their previous domains. But, of course, Louis couldn't stick to his plan. With his favorite son, Charles, still out of an inheritance, Louis decided to make everyone angry by carving out Burgundy, Alemannia, and Bavaria and giving them to Charles. Louis the German, who had never really been given much more than Bavaria, and who had been the first to come to his father's side in the last conflict, was livid and rose up in revolt. He had worked with his father, and in return had lost the lion's share of his kingdom. Once again, Louis demonstrated that his negotiating skills knew no bounds. Then, Pepin died in 838. Louis decided to give the entirety of the territory of Aquitaine to Charles, who now held an inheritance better than anyone else. The nobles of Aquitaine resisted this, however, and nominated Pepin's son, and a civil war was once again in full swing. These nobles soon proved to be a formidable force, conquering all the way to Paris, while Louis the German invaded the central area of Swabia. Just for good measure, Danish raiders also began pillaging the rich coastal cities still controlled by Louis the Pious. Lothar, who had been sitting on the sideline of the conflict, found himself able to demand terms from his father, and for the first time ended up joining forces with him in exchange for a greater part of the inheritance. The two decided to quickly come to terms with Louis the German, ceding him all territory of central and eastern Germany. The two then proceeded to wage a campaign against the Aquitanian nobles, who were eventually crushed. Now needing to once again redraw the map of the kingdom, Aquitaine was officially given to Charles, but Lothar would regain control of northeastern France and Alemannia. Louis the German chose this time to make a fuss about the deal, and was quickly crushed, his kingdom being reduced to the territory of Bavaria. With his favorite son finally granted a kingdom, and now loyal Lothar holding the rest, Louis the Pious took this chance at last to die. Louis the Pious was basically unsuccessful in almost every goal he established. The problem started for him when he decided to bring up the issue of succession way too early in his reign. This left his heirs with many decades before they would receive their inheritance and much time to improve it. Had he instead waited until later in his life to settle the issue, he could have spent his reign focusing on other issues. But instead, the conflict with his three sons ended up consuming his entire reign. He was, in that respect, extremely lucky that both the Moors and Byzantines were preoccupied at the time. But even though Louis put himself in a bad position from the beginning, he continually made it worse by refusing to stick to a plan. He proved to be inconsistent. He would rapidly change his mind, and often ended up aggravating everyone around him far more than was necessary. He would try to please everyone, then come up with a new plan, and keep changing things until someone got fed up and declared war. For this reason, along with others we will talk about in a minute, he ends up being the last king of a united Francia. With Charles now old enough to fight his own battles, the three brothers took all of a month before they started fighting again. Louis the German, who had been reduced to nothing more than a minor king of a small territory, immediately declared war on Lothar, who had declared himself emperor over the entire kingdom, nullifying the partitions of the empire his father had made. After successfully routing his brother's army, Louis began marching on his capital at Aachen, at which point Charles decided to expand his own small kingdom of Aquitaine and joined forces with Louis. The two brothers were unable to fully dislodge Lothar, but sensing that his side was doomed, Lothar negotiated new borders with the two brothers. I doubt they knew it at the time, but this partition of the empire would prove to be the flashpoint of modern Western Europe. In what has become known as the Treaty of Verdun, the three brothers divided the kingdom into roughly equal sizes. Starting with Charles, he now controlled most of modern France, stretching from the Pyrenees as far south as Barcelona and encompassing all of western and central France except Brittany, as far north as modern Belgium. To the east, Louis the German had vastly expanded his claims. He now controlled all of western Germany as far north as Hamburg, including all lands except for Bohemia and Prussia, as well as eastern Switzerland and Austria. Lothar, on the other hand, managed to pull the short end of the stick. He still controlled all of northern Italy, but north of that, his territory became a thin sliver stuck between his two brothers' kingdoms. His land contained what is today the Netherlands, eastern Belgium, Luxembourg, Alsace-Lorraine, western Switzerland, and Burgundy, as far south as Provence. This still encompassed most of the wealthy cities of the kingdom, like Lyon, Ghent, Verdun, and Aachen, and was probably the most populous, but geographically, it was an absolute mess. On either side was more contiguous empires with very long borders. The kingdom was split in two by the Alps, and most of it was flat land with no natural boundaries. This single event is the flashpoint of so much of European history. Because what you have now is a France to the west, a Germany to the east, and in between a no man's land that doesn't quite fit in with either. It is in this territory that grows into Belgium and the Netherlands, tiny countries just different enough from their larger neighbors. The incredibly contentious territory of Alsace-Lorraine, over which many of Europe's great wars were fought. And key to our story, it also encompassed Switzerland. But among these three, Switzerland is unique. It has been drawn up across ethnic lines, but unlike the rest of the kingdom, it did actually have geographic boundaries. Above all, it is the Alps that not only allow, but force a group of people who are not part of France or Germany or Italy to coexist. It is right here, right now, where, for the first time since the Helvetians went marching south to find better grazing land, a Swiss identity is beginning to form. Now, it should come as no surprise that this kingdom was not long for this world. There is a messy bit of history that follows, with each of Lothar's sons receiving a chunk of territory, then each calling on the bigger kingdoms to help them amass power. By the end, Charles and Louis the German had split most of the territory, except the Italian realms on the far side of the Alps. But now, there are two kingdoms, with a border drawn only out of political interests. The two will, of course, immediately begin fighting. And in the coming centuries, the next few episodes for us, we will begin to see Switzerland emerge out of this conflict. As always, if you have any questions, comments, concerns, declarations, manifestos, or affidavits, feel free to send them to historyoflittleeurope@gmail.com. Stay tuned, be sure to subscribe, and give the show a 5-star rating. Until then, pozdravljanje, ciao, and goodbye.